Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. There are two basics of survival, food and clothing. But the way we approach those basics has evolved radically over time. We'll get to clothes in the second half of the show. But first up, food. How do you break through with a new idea? How do you compete with the Nabiscos and the Pepsis of the world? And how do you set something that's new apart when in a regular supermarket, not a mega mart, there are approximately 38,718 products? Stephanie Lawson joins us from the marketing department at Suffolk University. Stephanie Lawson, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk about introducing new products, but how do you make inroads when consumers have that kind of choice?
One of the most dangerous things, I think, for new products is understanding that choice can often paralyze consumers and force them to keep buying the products they've bought in the past.
So, yeah, to talk about that idea of choice, normally we think, you know, if we can have three shampoos to choose from, fine. But if we can have 30, that would be great because then we'll find exactly the one that's right for us. But in some ways, choice doesn't quite work that way, does it?
Right. It's actually a paradox. A researcher named Barry Schwartz actually discussed this in a book called Paradox of Choice. And what he found is that, of course, consumers will say, I want as many choices as I can possibly have. I want 500 different lettuces to choose from. But the truth is, once you get into the store and you're trying to make a decision, it's overwhelming. Because oftentimes when we're in the grocery store, we're busy. We have other things to think about. We have price sensitivities. We have someone else with us that needs to get someplace quickly. And so we don't have a lot of time to spend in the store. And so oftentimes we end up making a choice and in the end feel, you know, some type of remorse for purchasing that product or wish that maybe we had tried something else. And so our satisfaction level is actually lower when we have too many choices.
So what do we end up doing if we're confronted with 100 choices of cereal?
Well, a couple of different things can happen. One, you can choose to put off the choice. You know, you could just not buy anything and walk away. Two, you can maybe make a choice, but maybe you wouldn't maximize your choice. You're not going to make sure you get the one you would really, really like. You just get the same one you bought before and say, oh, this is just good enough. So you're satisficing instead of maximizing. It also depends on consumers' personalities. You know, some consumers are more willing to spend the time to look for the product they really want and kind of suffer through that choice, and then they are very loyal to that product. Whereas other consumers, they use heuristics. You know, this is the cheapest one today. This is the one I had a coupon for. I heard about this product recently, and they'll just get that product and walk out of the store.
Stephanie Lawson, Assistant Professor of Marketing at Suffolk, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And joining me are a few food entrepreneurs. Sarah Granulati, founder of Coco Mama, which makes natural and gluten-free foods. Jason McCray, founder and CEO of McCray's Candies, which uses old-fashioned techniques to produce caramels. And Nicole Dawes, founder of Late July, an organic snack food company. And I should say that her dad started Cape Cod Potato Chips, a company that started local and went national. And I'm also joined by Glenn Kelly, who teaches marketing at Babson College. And Glenn, let me just ask you about what sets entrepreneurs in the food business apart from entrepreneurs in other industries. What can make it difficult to introduce a new product into the market?
The issue with the food industry is you've got, as you were saying, you know, you might have 50,000 products in a supermarket, depending on what supermarket chain size and scope. And there's slotting fees.
You know, what is a slotting fee?
Paying for shelf space. And in this day and age, two things have to happen. You have to get the product into the store, which is a very, very, very hard thing for these folks to do. And that's the good news. And then once you're in the store, you got to figure out how to have it move, because if products don't move off the shelves, they're not going to keep it on the shelf. So it's a dual problem. So you've got to get it in. Once you get it in, how are you going to sell it through? And these companies don't have resources to do any advertising. These are food products. If you have got a good food product, there's one thing you've got to do. You've got to get it in the customer's hand. You got to get it in their mouth. So you have to do a lot of grassroots creative ideas, a lot of guerrilla marketing. Sampling is really important, and you can only be so many places. I mean, these companies have 4 people, 10 people, you know, startups, and it's the classic situation where you don't have the resources, you don't have the money, but somehow, some way, you've got to figure out a way to get these wonderful tasting products into someone's hand and ultimately into their mouth.
You're talking about money. You know, if you're Nabisco and you're rolling out a new, you know, chocolate vanilla marbleized cookie, you can put $100,000, right, in advertising behind that, even though it hasn't launched yet, because you've got a vast reserve of cash.
Right, and they could spend millions. The other thing is their sales force. You know, they've got a lot of people on the ground. These entrepreneurs I'm sitting with here, they're probably out there doing it themselves and with a little bit of help. And the wonderful thing I was saying earlier is that you love to see these success stories, though, because it's very hard to make a product successful with so many products that fail in this industry. But when you get a good product and you can break through and you put the passion behind it, you know, you can look at a lot of categories in the food industry where there have been some real success stories. It's great to get to that point where you break through, but getting there and figuring out creative ideas and ideas that are going to move the brand and move the business is very challenging.
We're talking about food innovation. I'm Kara Miller, and Nicole Dawes, founder of Late July, let me go to you on that. You saw Cape Cod potato chips and Chatham Foods. You saw those both created and then, of course, sold off. Now you're creating your own business. How difficult is it to get from that great idea to getting it in people's mouths, getting it in the store?
It's very difficult. You want to increase the number of impressions, the number of times a consumer is going to see your product in that store.
What were the first foods that you were getting in the supermarket or the store and handing out to people?
With Late July, we started with a line of crackers, and then we launched cookies, and then just recently we launched tortilla chips.
And were there big obstacles at first, you know, trying to get people to actually spend the money to buy something that is, I assume, is it a little more expensive than sort of Tostitos?
Well, that's one of the things that I think is very important about organic foods, and that's something we've tried real hard to do at Late July, is to make sure that our foods are always of value. They're not cheap, they're not inexpensive, but that the consumer perceives them to be of value. And, you know, like our tortilla chips are not more expensive than all natural tortilla chips. Even though we're organic. We are more expensive than the conventional aisle. But when the consumer is shopping in the all-natural aisle, ours are, you know, pretty much the same price as all the other tortillas that they have to choose from. So, you know, we're not asking the consumer to make a big leap of faith with us.
And Sara Graniolati, you're in a really interesting space, the gluten-free space. So first of all, talk about how you got into it and then how you tried to bring the product that you created into stores.
So I was lucky that my first job out of college and out of undergrad was in the natural and organic product industry. It's more than just food, the whole industry as a whole, which over the past 15 years has seen tremendous growth even during recession times. So it's been a very exciting business to be in, something that is both personally and professionally a passion. But in 2008, I was diagnosed with some food allergies. And when I had to purchase in a different way, even though I was coming at it from being an industry veteran, I right away saw clear gaps. And there was no nutritious option. You know, if you had to take basically wheat and other gluten grains out of your diet, where were the whole grains? And so it was white rice, corn, tapioca, soy, corn. You know, it just, there wasn't really anything with that value proposition. And it took complaining to a few industry friends for them to kind of turn it on me and say, why don't you do it? So since then, it's been this goal of coming out with a product line that, you know, represents, there's so many other grains in this world. And as a country, we've become very used to eating the same ingredients. It's, you know, if you look in your cereal aisle, it's wheat, rice, corn, and oats. And here I am, I'm coming in and saying, there's quinoa, there's millet, there's amaranth, there's chia, there's all these other grain foods that really anyone can eat and enjoy. So that was the whole inspiration. And
now, is it that our cereal aisle is dominated by the grains that you talked about because that's what's inexpensive, that's what's subsidized? I mean, I just wonder if we get into the more exotic grains, are the prices going to go up?
Right. I think it's twofold. I mean, yeah, it is what's inexpensive, and people are used to paying, you know, $2 for a box of cornflakes. Well, all you're getting is corn. You know, you're not getting any kind of protein or high fiber, or you're not getting fruit in that. You're just buying a box of corn. I think, you know, in addition to that, I think that a lot of brands have just made products that they know consumers are comfortable with and know, you know, that easy adoption. But I think we also just as a country are recognizing, you know, the Food Network's like the new MTV. You know, we're becoming a more aware society and we're breaking down our barriers and looking beyond what's just here. And so I think that now there are other people realizing, hey, we need to be offering diversity in our diet. We have a lot of health problems as a nation. And, I think we do need to be looking at the foods that we're eating and making sure we're optimizing.
Okay, so you're diagnosed with food allergies, and did you go into your kitchen to create the product that you have now? Was that the first step of just buying things and testing recipes?
Actually, the first step was recognizing the problem and then coming up with the solution, which was there's all these ancient grains that I mentioned, and I'm talking more than just the breakfast aisle, just in general, that I thought you can make a lot of great healthy, versatile foods from these grains. So the concept of the brand was ancient grains and whole grain, but also gluten-free products. And then it was deciding what was going to be our first product. And so that was definitely a challenge because I had a few ideas in the snacking category, in the breakfast category, and bars, and it was really deciding what was going to be best. And so I decided to go a little more innovative with our first product, doing something no one's done before, which has had its pros and cons. But I think one of the pros is, you asked about getting on shelf. And that I think that has helped me get on shelf to where I'm launching right now in 230 stores this month, because the product is quite different. And there's retailers that appreciate that because they know that they're this whole part of this cultural shift of consumers knowing more about their food. They're demanding new and different and looking to try something. So we have a quinoa cereal that's similar to an oatmeal. It's actually already been cooked, and it's in a pouch for you, and it's dairy-free and gluten-free. And, also there's just a lot more people needing gluten-free options, and, it also fills that need for retailers.
What do you see in that space? That's a really interesting space that I think 10 years ago you would have said it, and people would have done a double take. Wait, what?
5 years ago.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So what's going on in the gluten-free space as an insider?
Symptoms for anyone with gluten issues, they are ambiguous. It's not a very clear cut. And even the diagnosis within issues with gluten, I have an allergy. So I actually have a histamine response when I ingest wheat. But then there's people that have gluten sensitivity. And then there's people with an autoimmune disease called celiac. So there's many reasons people are adopting a wheat-free or a gluten-free diet. In addition, it causes inflammation in the body for anybody. It's just some are more sensitive to it than others. So someone that might have rheumatoid arthritis can see a benefit from cutting wheat out of their diet. So there's just been a growing demand because the consumer base has grown. And it's legitimate. It's not, this is a diet to lose weight. This is really a way of living for medical reasons. And I think that at first, when it was a smaller base, the few companies that were making the products, they didn't need to take too much time to spend on taste. And they were just trying to get products to fill a need, which was very niche at that time. Well, now it's a growing base of consumers who are like, hey, I want my taste. I want my nutrition. I want my convenience. And the demands are there. And now there are more companies and entrepreneurs like me who are trying to meet those needs. And especially there's a lot that are like me who we eat this way, and so we understand the pain points there.
We're talking about food innovation, and Glenn Kelly from Babson, let me go to you on this issue of gluten-free, organic, which is everybody on the show today, and I didn't even design it this way, markets their products as natural or organic or gluten-free. What's happening in those specialized areas in terms of this explosion of popularity?
Right, and I think what Sarah was saying is a very smart strategy that she decided when she decided to go further out on the product offering, because you have to have a product that has a major point of differentiation when you're a small niche company. And I think there's a great opportunity in this gluten-free area. And if you're real, if you're credible, if you're believable, if you have it. I think, if you look at the numbers, you look at the research, you look at the medical research, this problem is not going away, and it's going to continue to grow in the United States and our society. So I think you're going to see a lot more companies trying to get to this place of, if they're not doing it now, they will be doing it.
Now, when you see companies try to scale up and they get bigger, as hopefully, all the companies we're talking to today will, what are the challenges when you get bigger and you're dealing with distributing food all over the place, getting it into different supermarkets, doing it quickly, doing it efficiently? What are the challenges?
Right. Well, there's a long list of challenges. And I think for these niche brands, if I were running these companies personally, I would focus. And I would try to focus in key areas The woman mentioned this before with partnering with retailers. And I would, if you're in Whole Foods or you're in some stores like that that are right in the wheelhouse where these products should be sold, build that relationship there. And the question strategically is, how much can you sell into that channel versus trying to sell in a lot of different places? Now, eventually, you want to be in a lot of locations. But to start out, I think you really want to focus because you don't have people. You don't have the sales force. I mean, these people don't have sales forces. You know, the bigger brands, they've got hundreds and thousands of people out there selling. So as you continue to grow, you have to start making decisions. You know, are we going to use a broker? Are we going to use a food broker? Are we going to use an importer? Are we going to use somebody else's sales force? How are we going to get this product out there? And I think they could build these brands to a pretty good revenue base just by staying focused in maybe a geographic area. And I think some brands, when they try to grow and they try to grow too quickly, they lose their mission, they lose their base, they lose their brand, you know, stance and where they planted the flag. And so there's a whole host of distribution issues and distribution costs and how you're going to get that product out there that have to be factored in. I would look at examples and analogies of companies that have done well when they're very, very small, dealing in a big category, the spirits category, you know, a new spirit brand or an up-and-coming spirit brand competing against Diageo and, you know, Bacardi. Like a Gosling's rum trying to compete with Bacardi. So those are the challenges that you face. And at some point, I think an entrepreneur has to decide, you know, can they get the backing? Can they get the money? Are they making a profit? And then they make a decision, well, you know, I'm going to try to do this alone or I'm going to partner with people, try to get some investment, or eventually maybe sell the company. And I think most entrepreneurs have it in mind that I'm going to build this, I'm going to get to a certain level, take another look around. Maybe I'll sell it. Maybe I'll keep building it. Maybe I'll partner with somebody. Other strategies that these niche brands can use, cause marketing is another classic marketing strategy.
What is cause marketing?
Cause marketing is when you sell your product and you partner with a charity. But again, you've got to be real. You've got to be honest. You've got to be credible. You've got to be believable. I mean, you're doing it not self-serving.
Well, and we actually see, I don't know if you would classify this in the same area, but we certainly see like Stonyfield Yogurt or Ben & Jerry's. Those have always been companies that had a social mission.
Absolutely.
At their core, that they were making ice cream, but they were trying to do something else too.
Absolutely. Those are two great examples that you just mentioned. Very successful companies. They were in competitive categories. They were up against big brands. But they always had a culture and a social mission as well.
Jason McCray, I want to, you know, we've talked about sort of different themes. And I know that one of the themes with the candy company and with your caramels is sort of doing things the way they were done 100 years ago, making candy the way it used to be made instead of the sort of factory way that it is mm-hmm. made now. How important is that as sort of part of telling your story? And do you see that sort of going back to the old-fashioned way of making food as a trend?
I'm not sure if it's a trend, but it seems to fit well for what we're trying to do, and it feels right for us. I always like to think that I take a scientific approach, so I'm sort of combining new flavors, doing interesting, innovative things with the caramel, but ultimately the caramel is an old-fashioned kind of a product. We have a few antique candy wrapping machines that we've restored to help us produce the product, but they're really showstoppers to see them running. And just funny things like that. For me, that's what's really the fun part about it. I mean, we try and have fun, and there's a lot of, it's like old school technology to make something that's modern.
And Nicole Dodds, let me direct the last question to you about Late July. You really try to distinguish yourself in the organic category, which is really tough. And I wonder, this is a category that's increasingly getting crowded. People know that customers are willing to pay more for organic food. When you look ahead, how do you see yourself distinguishing the company from competitors?
Well, I feel that organic is going to represent the future. I mean, I'm building this company for, you know, 20, 40 years from today. And I think that if we could have a crystal ball and look back from there to where we are now, we'll see that the companies like the people on this call today are the companies that are defining kind of who our food business will be moving forward. Because the reality is when you talk to moms and they're shopping, you know, no mom is going to tell you, I want my child food filled with toxic chemicals, pesticides, GMOs, if they have a choice. And the large companies are realizing that. you know, they're waking up to what the consumers are truly asking for. But the companies, like the people on your call today, are the ones that are defining their authentic voice in that world. And we are the ones that are going to redefine who our food business is 20 years from today. So, I mean, to me, the best way to remain competitive and make sure that we stand out in the crowd is to never forget kind of who we are and how, why we started in the first place, and really continue to be about the mission that we're on and about creating that authentic message, that trust that I've developed with my consumers, so that no matter how big Late July gets, they always know what we stand for. And when they pick up one of our products, they know exactly what they're going to be getting.
Nicole Dawes, founder of Late July, an organic snack food company. Sarah Granulati, founder of Coco Mama, which makes natural and gluten-free foods. Jason McRae, founder and CEO of McRae's Candies, which uses old-fashioned techniques to produce caramels. And Glenn Kelly, adjunct professor of marketing at Babson College. Thanks so much to all of you for being here. To find out more about our guests or to hear our podcasts, check out our website, wgbh.org/innovationhub. When we come back, how the clothing industry may be radically changing, starting with some technology borrowed from NASA. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub.